Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode number 180 of the Ant King Frequency. See, I do this thing with my voice, Larry, before the start of every show where I kind of flip a switch and it gets this kind of tone. And I get really tired about 15 minutes in and start talking like normal.
Yeah, that energy drains out of you. So that life just like, hey, I'm happy. And then life just settles in and you just have to mellow out like
it's,
that.
It's not happiness. I think I just take my foot off the accelerator or something, because I do a conscious thing to get this kind of voice.
Well, I can talk like this, Pilgrim.
But
we'll
for how long?
About comic books. Well, we'll see. Today, this goes more to Howard Cosell.
I was going to say.
Episode 180. 180 is a big deal. Hulk 180 had the appearance of who?
First appearance of Wolverine. Everyone miscredits it to 181, but the final backsplash had Wolverine in it.
It did. And the Wolverine at that time, he was supposed to be a mutated Wolverine. And at that time, they didn't know what to do with him. He became the legend, the man, the myth, the sickly boy in a nightgown that had bone claws.
No, that's Joe Quesada to thank for that crap.
Well, with this, what do you expect from a guy who created his hero, who was a fireman, who had an axe for a hand, or something along those lines?
I bet he had really lonely Friday nights home. How are you, Larry?
I am doing quite well.
Okay, you're going to stick with this. Okay, I'm sure it's pissing off listeners because it's grating on my nerves, but I'm impressed.
Look at that Antonio go. With these issues we've had to deal with lately, with the weather, thankfully, my patch over my roof held. I had to put tar paper and more nails to hold things down. It rained, it poured, but it did not leak. So things are going quite well for me, my friend.
Okay, cool. That's cool.
I think he's going to lose his mind. He's looking at me like, please, will he stop? Break the bit.
I don't know what to think. I like I said, I'm impressed. If you could keep this up, that's great. I think it may be alienating some listeners because it sounds like, I don't know, you might be giving birth in between those pregnant pauses, but who knows?
You made Howard Cosell snort, but not a line of cocaine, a line of comic books.
Right.
Comic books in particular, the X-Men line.
So it might be
what about X-Men?
A change of form for Howard there. But yeah.
It doesn't mean I can't hide things under my toupee.
Okay. All right. Well, look, you did mention comic books, and you posted something on Twitter today, Larry, about some botched up color correction for Superboy number one. And this was on a collected reprint that was digitally done. And this has sort of triggered me like some kind of manic triggered person is the most diplomatic way I could say what I was going to say next, into really lamenting the colouring of old. And I think it's one of those hugely neglected fields of colouring. Everyone, you know, has the joke about inkers thanks to Kevin Smith, but the colourers really have a key role to play in the presentation of the comic book tableau that we've come to know. So, Larry King, I wanted to talk today about comic book coloring.
Well, with comic book
coloring, no, dude, seriously.
No, you have to understand. just like what Kevin Smith, a glorified grocery clerk who worked at a fast food, sorry, not a fast food, a quick stop, close enough. If he worked at McDonald's, he would have more credit than making films where, hey, I talk about dick jokes and fart jokes and put it in black and white to give myself credit. If he'd put it on VHS, maybe he would have had more style and more substance, but he does not. Okay, I'm a quick.
Yeah, thank God, because I just can't follow it. I can't follow it, man. Because everything's in fragments. My brain keeps resetting like a goldfish at the start of each fragment.
Like, we'll talk like this, man. Oh, this Kevin Smith talking about. No, I don't do that.
Comic book colors, Larry.
Okay. Well, comic book coloring, you have the issue where people today, they're so reliant on digital just because you put highlights on stuff. So just because you can, you know, add more colors and work with a CMYK instead of RGB and, you know, red, green, blue, CMYK, you know, cyan, magenta, yellow, and what's K stand for?
Black.
What?
Black.
Black? Okay. But when you're dealing with different approaches, it ruins the comics considering the modern coloring.
Technically, it's processed black, which is different to black when I learned back in my...
Okay, yeah. It's not the same as design with... But yeah, it's... Looking at comics today, and there are good colorists out there. I know a few of them. But... Majority of these people, when they approach these books, like, don't fix what ain't broken. Do a direct match as how they were initially printed, because that color for that art was how it's supposed to be. Don't recolor, you know, like they're Marvel, because they got the license for the Star Wars comics back. They're reprinting the old Star Wars movie comics, especially the ones for Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. Return of the Jedi, especially when you had artists like Al Williamson, who did the art for the Blade Runner comic adaptation,
yep,
which is one of my favorite things ever, and yours too. Mm-hmm. But that color needs to have traditional flat coloring from the past. It needs to have that rich, thick color. Not this new modern, you know, highlighted mess. And there are examples of on Google, if you look up Google image search. And that being the case, it just ruins. It takes a punch, and it ruins the original artwork. And people don't realize that. People don't realize the fact, I'd rather have no color than bad coloring. I'd rather have it be black and white than have instead of having bad coloring, because it's distracting.
But yeah,
this is how I come at it.
Well, I think we need to take a little, look in the via the Wayback Machine at why and how comic book coloring is what it is and what it's known for. I mean, if you look at the quintessential comic book, it'll be like a Lichtenstein print, where it's that color halftone kind of pattern. That's what everyone thinks of with comic books. The trope when there's any film or TV show sending up comics is they've got that little pixelated zipper tone colored pattern for comic books. And that came from the sheer physics and mechanics of printing colors from what was originally a two or four color printing press only. Am I right?
Yeah, exactly. It was physically printed onto the page as a layer of itself. That's, you know, you had to tell the machine where to put what colors where. And that's why sometimes you'd see comics, if they screwed up or the machine had messed up, the colors would be printed a little off. It almost looks like a 3D image.
Yeah.
Like they're going for a 3D look, but unintentionally, because it's not going to work as a 3D, because you need a green, red and a blue.
Yeah, and this is the same technology as newspapers. I mean, it's almost embarrassing now. You pick up a newspaper and look at a cover photo. I don't know, newspapers, what are they, huh? And it's the resolution and quality of the image is almost indiscernible from you know, a high-end photographic print. But originally, if you grew up in the 80s like us, you looked at a photo in a newspaper, and it was very pixelated, made up of a series of printing dots. And comic books were not dissimilar. So they could only imply, using physical trickery of light, certain colours. They could only print pure colours in the forms of that the base colours that they had available to them. And that was depending on the publication and the press and the materials available at the time, which is why a lot of World War II era comic books were so limited in their colours and very reliant on just base red and green, because oftentimes that was all they could have available on them for the printing press. You pick up, you know, one of the Submariner War issues and everything's either red or green. Even the water is greenish because of those two inks available to them at the time. It was about a bargain of economy. And it defined the look, and it worked because this was all printed on cheap, porous newsprint paper that soaked up.
And that's how it's supposed. And it's supposed to be like that. And that's the problem with a lot of these comics today. When they do comics, everybody's like, "Well, you need to do modern coloring techniques. You have to put it on the modern paper, which is a very glossy stock. It's usually recycled, but the ink never dries."
Yeah.
If you have a tiny bit of moisture on your hands, like say if you live in a humid environment, then you're going to smudge the ink no matter what. You're going to make the paper bubble from your body heat alone, which isn't, you know, you're 98.6 unless you run it like a, you know, a fever, and even then the paper bubbles up because it's bad paper. It's a bad stock.
Well, people also forget. Sorry, go on.
No, go ahead.
People also forget that comic books were apocryphally introduced to basically keep the printing presses running when the newspaper wasn't being printed. Is that right, Larry, or am I misunderstanding that?
Comic books, the
funny pages, I should say.
Well, the comics in general, the way modern comics spun out of. They had a genius idea. So we've been putting these comics, the daily comics, the weekly comics, the Sunday strips. We've been putting this stuff in the newspapers for the longest time, and well, they're just they appear once, and then the next weeks, that kind of thing. So someone had the genius idea of taking these pages, that these comic strips, which are landscape formats, one stack of images, like say three panels, five panels, whatever, and cutting them up and pasting them in a book format and then having them printed up. And so they were reformatted reprints of newspaper stuff. And then they said, hey, let's start publishing our own comics, like the own, you know, like original ideas on these pages. And that's how you get stuff like Superman or Marvel Comics and Wonder Woman and Captain Marvel and all this other stuff, where these new ideas. And people don't realize back in the day, these comics were not 20 pages. They were 60 pages for like 10 cents.
Yep.
You know, where you had like in the first Action Comics, not only did you have Superman, you had Slam Bradley.
Yep.
You know, and you had Zatara, if I'm not mistaken. You know, so you had these characters that had legs, you know, for the longest, well, you know, for quite a while. A lot of her derivative, Captain America, is a ripoff of the Archie character, the Shield.
Yeah. There was also Fighting American, which was released around the same time as well.
Fighting American actually was Kirby and Simon, but they did that in the 1950s after Marvel screwed them out of.
Oh, really? So Rob Liefeld was wrong when he relaunched that.
No, what happened is this. Marvel, you know, of course, Marvel being Martin Goodman's company, Martin Goodman's nephew, Stan Lee. So he was, you know, nepotism, whatever. But Marvel screwed Kirby and Simon, Joe Simon, Jack Kirby, out of the creation, because that's just how it goes. A lot of these characters are fly by night. They have a couple appearances and they never get seen again. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
Until many, many years later, and some hipsters find it and like, oh my God, it's the greatest thing ever. Whatever. But with Fighting American, they created that, and it was supposed to be like Captain America for the 50s, where he's fighting communism. They did that for like the first few issues, and then they like, let's stop fighting. This is just like getting too political, getting too stupid. And then they go full over the top crazy stuff, like fighting an Eggman, and you know this, you know, basically fighting the Mama Fratelli from the Goonies, basically equivalent. She's like an ugly woman with a gun and all that stuff. So it's like basically it's Mama Fratelli from the Goonies. And years later, that's when Liefeld supposedly made a deal for Fighting American, and then just basically made Fighting American nothing but Captain America, and then they had a chance to run. It became a mess. But then what's funny is Marvel reprinted Fighting American as a hardcover in like 1988. So they collected it, reprinted it, and then of course that went out of print because the whole Kirby Simon deal, and they're like, nope, in this. But then in the 90s,
Liefeld restarted it.
He supposedly made a deal with the Kirby estate,
and that was with Awesome Comics, which was a Liefeld owned imprint, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was one of the many Liefeld imprints that, because he had Extreme and Awesome and Maximum, and he had all these other imprints. Like one would fail, he'd just start up a new imprint. And it's funny because Liefeld was one of the Image founders. Now, the Image books, when they first got printed, especially Youngblood, if you notice in the first issue of Youngblood, if you have it, it's a good thing to have because you can learn from the past. So you don't need to repeat it. Like, learn from the mistakes of these people. Actually printed by Malibu. Now, Malibu, same people who did the Ultra Force books, the Nightman.
Malibu is Black Marvel, isn't it?
What do you mean?
Marvel for African Americans. Like, they've got Rocket and Icon and all the...
No, you're thinking of Milestone.
Oh, Milestone.
That's the DC. Sorry. That's the DC, because they have Static Shock. They have those guys. Well, Malibu had... was a company that had previously purchased
that that big tanky guy, Supreme or something was his name?
Prime,
that's it. Prime.
Yeah, his little kid who got covered in like green ooze and turns into a big, instead of saying Shazam, he just like this ooze forms up around like snot. It looks like if Slimer turned
into Captain Marvel on steroids.
Yeah, basically. In Captain Marvel for the 90s, which is funny because they already had a Captain Marvel book and Power of Shazam, but whatever. Yeah. Which actually, that was a really good book, Jerry Ordway. But Malibu had bought a company called Aircel. Aircel, A-I-R-C-E-L, was a Canadian company that had produced some comics. One of the comics in particular they produced was Men in Black by Lowell Cunningham. Now, Malibu was kind of the cutting edge really in the 90s. They had digital coloring techniques. Marvel wanted these coloring techniques so bad, they bought the company just to get the coloring techniques. Because when Malibu were putting out these books, all the creators owned the characters. So Malibu, but because it was tied to Malibu, there wasn't some kind of, if you don't use it within certain amount of years, it reverts back to the creators. They would do whatever they want.
Is that how they backed Starkings and Comicraft as well? Was that in the same deal? It was around the same time.
No, Starkings was a Comicraft. They were a independent. Okay. Comicraft was independent. That's why
these are the letterers, guys. If you're listening, if you're keeping up,
Richard Starkings went on to create Elephant Men. The Elephant Men stuff. And Hip Flask mainly. Hip Flask was an example of, hey, here's a fake comic character to show our lettering so you don't have to license out Marvel or DC character, and that caught its own life as...
Yeah. Maybe we'll do a thing on lettering later on, but it's fascinating lettering and arguably one of the hardest things about comics. One of the things I admire about you, Larry, before I get too off topic, we're talking about coloring today, but one of the things I admire about you is that you letter your own comics, and that's something in a million years I couldn't do.
I do it digitally, though. I used to do it by hand. Now
I know you
used
to do it by hand.
But here's the problem doing it by hand. You screw up, you have to go back.
And yeah.
It's a nightmare.
But still, you've done it by hand, and that's amazing to me.
I've done it traditionally. I've done it by hand digitally by writing it on the page, on the digital page itself on a different layer, and I've done it in a typed format with a I forgot the name of the type set, what it's called. But what happened is Malibu got bought by Marvel, and because Marvel owns Malibu, and if they used any Malibu characters, that's why you didn't see. Remember they did that Juggernaut joined this group called the Exiles. He had Gam short time, but after that, nothing.
Yeah.
The reason is if they used those characters, they'd have to pay the creators like full like basically usage. It's like when remember that TNG episode where not Tom Paris and the group of cadets and Wesley, and there's a guy that dies and they're supposed to keep their mouth shut.
Yep.
And the same actor plays Tom Paris in Voyager. He goes to jail, and then in Voyager, a character very similar to that character gets, you know, like yep. he gets released from jail. The reason it's not the same character, because they would have to pay the rights to the writer of that TNG episode,
because
for every single not just like one lump sum, every yeah. single time that Tom Paris character appears, you'd have to
every same day thing I'm reminded of how much people are arsehole covered arseholes with a crunchy arsehole shell and a creamy arsehole center.
Enjoy bleeping this out, my friend.
No, I don't think I have to bleep that one out. That's one of those borderline words. But
okay,
iTunes, come at me, bro, if you want me to do that. But look,
hey, if it's in Spaceballs, it's okay.
Taking a step back, that's not the best litmus test, by the way. If it's in Spaceballs, it's okay. There's a lot of stuff in Spaceballs which wouldn't pass the PC test nowadays. But anyway, so 4CP. That's the nickname nowadays for the four-color process that started this whole ball rolling. But it wasn't just coloring. It wasn't just filling in the lines. I mean, they were making the best of cheap paper, cheap printing, a separation method of coloring that left everything exposed. If they screwed up, they screwed up. They had to make colors out of layering crossed over other colors. So to make purple, they obviously had to layer pinkish red or cyan and magenta to make a purpley kind of color. So number one, two things happened out of this. It was on cheap paper, which sucked up the colors and sucked up certain colors. And as the paper yellowed and grew older and little bits of mold accumulated, colors slightly changed too. So the paper itself informed the color and presentation of the piece. This I love. This yep. It just, for me, this stuff gets me high on the magic of what comic books used to be. The second element was, based on the restrictions and availability of certain colors, you know, Marvel's Spider-Man is a perfect example of this. The coloring itself became a shorthand of who was the hero and who was the villain. There is no coincidence behind the fact that almost the entirety of Marvel's pre-90s Rogues Gallery are all green.
I didn't even realize that till just now. It's like you got Dr. Octopus, the Lizard, the Scorpion,
the
Green
Vulture.
Goblin, Vulture. Oh my God.
So all of those characters created in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Like you're seeing it now, Larry. You're starting to see the Matrix here.
Mole Man.
Yep.
Dr. Doom. Ben Fang Foom. Who else we got? Oh, Ronan the Accuser. Galactus is a whole thing. Who else? Wow, that's a lot.
But you'll find...
X-Men had a little different, but that's...
Yeah, but you'll find that coloring became a shorthand for who was who, so you could easily identify who was on the screen, and also an easy way to instruct the colorist to fill in the piece. We know the hero because he's red. Let's separate that color. He's over there. We know the villains because they're green, and we can also color them all the same. Hey, which villain on this panel? Doesn't matter. Paint him green. Less of a case over in DC, but it was still applied to that blue was the blanket color for everyone, which is why the highlights for anyone with black hair or a black costume or anything was blue, because you just knew to chuck blue somewhere in that silhouette there.
And blue still works really well. I found that out because I do my comics myself. I color. I most recently did a called Digital Deluxe Edition for Ace Number One, now available for sale. See my Twitter page and you'll for further information. But I did a color interior, all 16 pages plus some bonus material. But when I still do, if a person has like especially black hair or dark hair, instead of doing just like the white highlights, like the white shining, you know, like the light shining in the hair, I will do blue. Because blue is just, it's a it's shorthand. It's comic book shorthand for black hair. Superman has black hair, but you'd see blue in it because this is how it goes.
Yeah.
So that's what I do.
And that's always there. And you look at the blue of Superman. I mean, look at the blue of Superman in Justice League, for instance, and compare it with the blue used in DC's Superman, even up to the 90s. And he was almost in bright cyan. He's like in greeny, rude blue. It's fascinating the difference at play. But ultimately, the side product here was that you got finished artwork, and I've just sent Larry you a couple of comparisons. Sorry for the listeners at home, you can't see this. But ultimately, you got an image that was informed not only by the black and white line work, but by also the very textured, pixelated tone and the noise of what was going on the paper underneath and the various fiber and oils and whatnot associated in the paper, so that a simple, in this example of Centellari, combination of purple, pink, blue and green and yellow became a far more complex and organic cacophony of work. Now, what I've done is I've sent him a modern digital recoloring of a print of the Fantastic Four drawn by, it's got to be Kirby looking at that contorted face.
It looks like Kirby because I was thinking Ditko at first, but it looks more like Kirby. Could be Buscema.
No, also looking at the thumbs there. And you know, a trick, you look at the knuckles, count the knuckles on the hand. Kirby always draws three knuckles where humans only have two. It's a little.
Well, I have four.
I got six. Yeah. Well,
I have seven. I'm one better.
Seven knuckles. Jesus Christ. You're like a raptor.
I was grabbing something while Antonio was talking. I picked these up years ago. They are old Thor. With, you know, Ego the Living Planet, which is another green guy.
Yep.
And how the colors are really, like, when you want to show, like, somebody's evil or having bad intent, you know, they'd have a red panel. You cover exactly. You know, color they cover. And that's one thing that's missing from a lot of the modern coloring techniques. And the fact that, like, when Kirby would do cosmic stuff, which people try to imitate it, but they absolutely fail, but you'd get... like that, you know, like there's these bleed throughs. So I'm showing Antonio these panels, but there are so many examples of an older comics. And this is all newsprint. This issue came out. Well, it's like kind of falling apart a little bit, but be careful. 1966. I'm holding this Kirby Thor from 1966. But yeah, it's a little ragged, rough around the edges. I think it's like a couple bucks for it.
I've actually got here, Larry, I've got a few of these. This is a Kirby reproduction cell. So this is what Marvel Comics used to use to basically make copies of their print. So this is an old Captain America cell. It's quite fascinating because you can't see it, but the... everything's all separated on different layers. The cells themselves, gutters are separated from the line work, which is separated from the text, and then it's got the print registration marks at the top. But this is ultimately what would have been printed for the comics, and because it's coming out on a four-color printing process on paper that bled, you got far more of a complex image. Whereas the equivalent, if you print this on modern stock, which is, you've already said, Larry, is glossy paper that doesn't absorb it, with inks that don't need to be mixed on the page, which come pre-made, it means you get something very flat. It means purple is just purple. It means a solid color is just a solid color. Now, that's only half the problem because I can live with it. It doesn't have that the color's not informed by the stock underneath it, which in my opinion is a loss. You've seen some of the artwork I color. I do like to to grade it as if
you make it, look like it's on newsprint. You make it look like it's on newsprint. And it's funny you mention that because there's a company. Actually, I talked to the guy that runs on
That's X-Men 1. Yeah.
Yep. Wow. That's nice. But
that's before kids and I used to buy things for myself.
I'm about to say good old days, but you know, I know you wouldn't trade your kids for the world, but
no.
But there's a company called Alterna Comics, actually run by one man, which is, I don't know how he does it. He's like a Jim Steranko type, gets like a few hours sleep a night. But one of his goals was to bring back newsprint, and all the floppy comics. Also, that's a the color stills, right?
So that this was used entirely for reproductions. And I bought these from a huge lot sale because Marvel were digitizing everything and they didn't need to keep these repros anymore.
That is, so you are the guy that has these pages.
Well, I only bought 4 or 5 pieces because they were still like a couple of hundred each and I'm not a millionaire.
But still, like you could scan that in, you could take a scanner layer in and...
This is a John Byrne Wolverine. Klaus Janson finishing it. I don't know why it was colored separately, but
that's nice. Damn, dude. You know what? I know that ain't the original artwork, but because it would be like one of a kind, but that itself is one of a kind as well.
Well, you know? it's like colors I'm talking about today, just a side of the industry no one ever talks or thinks about.
Yeah, it's Peter Smitty of Alterna. He brought back newsprint, and his newsprint comics, like the most they charge one for is $1.99, and that one's like a 60-page comic. It's an anthology, but most of the books are $1.50.
Yep.
And the there's a book that he publishes. The only thing he does is basically like Image, like a one man Image band, where it's creator-owned properties. He just publishes them. And one of the books in particular is called Scrimshaw. Now, Scrimshaw is post-apocalyptic, think Mad Max, Waterworld, X-Men, but more like... the art reminds me of Willis Portacio. Very Willis Portacio-style art. And the colors...
You mean early days when he was good, or like X-Force... Regenesis, even that, whatever it was called.
I come around to like it.
I know, but he's a wee bit... grim dark / attention deficit disorder.
Well, you blame Warren Ellis on that.
Yeah.
But you go to is if you look up one thing we got gypped on, there was a book he did called Stormwatch Team Achilles. And you looked it up if you wish, but
yeah.
It was the colors in that book were incredible. The line art was everything was like it felt like action packed. Like even if it was just like, hey, these two guys are talking, it felt like anything could happen. It felt like a Tony Scott film or something along those lines. Like a lot of or good Tony Scott films, or anything could happen. And these books, Peter Cimetti, Alterna, and these creators, because they print on newsprint, the color process, it gets absorbed. Now, granted, it isn't like 20, 30 years of being absorbed into the paper like a lot of these newsprint comics, but it gets absorbed in there and it looks great.
Yep.
Probably uses a modern coloring process, but it's that colors they use work extremely well for the newsprint. And it's wonderful to see that happen. But so many comics today, when they do that modern coloring on that modern stock, it doesn't really if it doesn't harm, it just doesn't help. It's just like, okay, it's just there. It's like wallpaper. It's like a Marvel movie score. You don't remember it. It's not memorable. It's extremely bad.
Well, but when my grandfather used to take me down to the news agent to get his lotto tickets of a Friday afternoon, he'd usually treat me to a comic book, and it'd be something of the time. It'd be Richie Rich or Casper or Transformers or something. One of the games I used to play in my 4 or 5-year-old head was spot the base color, like spot the color that wasn't made up of dots. I know it sounds really weird. This is just the way I worked and the reason why color is so resonant to me. But I always got a thrill when I found a color that was a base color, that it wasn't pixelated, it wasn't created by halftone. And to this day, even though the artwork fades, you can see those bass tones still pop with a power and a presence that sort of jumps off the page to the point where the black fades down, but the colours still pop. I've just shared a similar such picture with you, Larry, to give you an example of that, where you can see the reds and the blues and the yellows actually emerge out from the black ink that they've been printed over.
Yeah, they lift up out of it. And they're where the black is absorbed, you know, because the black has got absorbed and transferred more likely onto the next page. And
exactly.
The inks pop up.
So basically, because of the limitations at the time, and they added more colors to the four-color process. It became 16 in the 60s and went up to the 256 type palette in the 80s and 90s. But you still had certain colors that popped better than others. You still had certain colors that had certain implications. I mean, purple was the other Marvel villain color. So I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a traditional Marvel Comics villain that wasn't green or purple or a combination of both.
Yeah, and that was a very common...
Wrecking Crew, Vanisher, Annihilus. The list just goes on. Because of those...
I'm going to say, here's a perfect example. This issue of 131 of Thor.
Yep.
You have this purple lady, and then these. Right here.
Is that a Sentry? A Kree Sentry?
I don't know exactly. They're a different alien species. I forgot their name, but they're trying to take over Earth as always. I forgot their name. But yeah, they're. This is the same time when, and also the page one, all the using the dots.
Yeah.
To color Thor and Hercules. Though Hercules, they look really weird because it's Vince Coletta doing the ink, so he did a botched job. Everybody's like, oh, he isn't that bad. I'm like, yeah, give me a break. that's a whole other story. Says
word. But anyway. But
yeah, like...
The colors were always a you know how you'd watch a sitcom or something and there'd be some B-lister in there who'd still resonate with you. I remember watching the Blossom in the 90s. And for some reason, I really liked her older brother, Anthony. I don't know why. He wasn't really relevant to the plots. He wasn't important in the storyline. He's a pretty average actor. But I really liked that. For me, colors are the Anthony of the comic books. They just... they bring a presence... For me, and an element of enjoyment I can geek out on. So my tiny pubescent brain totally creamed their metaphorical pants when I discovered that gradients were a thing. And in one of my favorite books, Uncanny X-Men, you're starting to get colors that were changing mid-shape. So you'd have Psylocke's blade go from pink to white in her hand. You'd have skin tones go from dark orange to light pink. You know, and the pixelation was still there because the technology wasn't perfected. I mean, the issue where I really noticed it happening was that one where Psylocke gets gutted by Sabretooth while Boomer watches. That was an episode of
issue like Uncanny. X-Men 30-something? I think it was like around X-Men 30-something or whatever.
I thought it was an Uncanny.
I'm actually breaking out Uncanny X-Men number 267, which is during the Jim Lee run. And a fun example. It's a...
328, I think it is.
Okay, 328. Okay.
Yeah, that's the one.
Because I'm looking at this issue, it's I actually have never read this issue, so but I'm looking at the colors and it's for using some of that bleed through. That's one downside about newsprint, especially older newsprint stuff. It's you'll get a lot of, especially if it's a lot of black and a lot of darkness, it'll bleed and kind of gray everything out a little bit. But yeah, that's the thing. It's like there's a wow, they actually were able to, but it made it pink. They made it a solid color. But yeah, there is something with these issues that's like that you can't get today. Nostalgia factor mainly.
Because another trope of the comic book is that the artwork would be always amazing on the cover. So there would always be things like gradients and experimental inking and painting styles on the front cover art, but the inside would always be very flat, often four color. Sometimes with dodgy separations, so they're coming out of the lines, the same artwork. But it wasn't until really the mid-90s that things started to change. And we got the dawn of the modern colouring that we see today. And look, if I just jump to the chase, because this episode is really indulging me, hopefully Larry, but maybe not you the listener. What we've ended up with is a very generic, very, I think, boring and non-committal style of ultra realism in their colouring, where they don't really rely so much on line work and inking to give depth and shape like they used to, and they draw just very opaque, open-ended line work and let the colorist pick up all the visual information.
That's my biggest complaint about modern coloring, because modern line art as well, because the line artists, the pencilers, the inkers, the people that put the lines down on the page, they rely too heavily on the colorist to pick up the rest of the weight instead of actually finishing the artwork. Where if you were to, back in the day, Marvel used to put out the Marvel Essentials, which are black and white, these phone books, black and white comics.
We've talked about them several times in this show, yeah.
Yeah, they're beautiful works, though you get, like, you know, you have, like, you know, Brent Anderson, John Romita, John Byrne, you know, Mark Silvestri, these, you know, all these kind of artists doing their thing, Rick Leonardi, what have you. But you get these modern artists, these modern Marvel creators, you could never do it in black and white because it would look like garbage. You could barely tell what was going on. Lines are too thin. There's artists like Adrian Alfona and Josh Middleton. And if you look up their artwork, their pencil artwork, for example, there's a Josh Middleton page from Superman, Captain Marvel, First Thunder, which was a, like, basically Captain Marvel and Superman meeting up and, like, teaming up against some villains.
Yep.
And it was illustrated by Josh Middleton. But the colors were, of course, when he did the line work, finished art looks pretty good. But you look at the line art, and it's, like, nothing there. It's, like, the thinnest of lines. It looks not even a coloring book.
I own penciled artwork by Scott Wegner that he sold in a charity for Avengers mm-hmm. Earth Mightiest Heroes, which is, like, a cartoon adaptation of the Avengers series. And A, they're uninked because they didn't do any inks on the series. They just scan the mm-hmm. pencil straight in. And B, all the information is in the line work. Is in the colors. Yeah, I've got actual scans I made of this to show you, but it's just phenomenal. I was unimpressed when the artwork arrived. I'd previously bought a cover to Atomic Robo in the same auction that he'd done. It was a charity for the Japanese Fukushima plant, and I only bought it because he was complaining on a popular forum we used to frequent that no one was interested in donating to this charity. So I got them at a steal, I'm reluctant to admit, but because of that, it's just it's amazing comparing his inked work with his straight out pencils he did for Marvel, because they're thoroughly unimpressive.
I actually have a piece of artwork. I don't know if I ever showed it to you. Let me grab that real quick if I can. My headphones will reach. I don't want to pull my laptop. Oh, it's over here someplace. I think that's the right one. It is not. Well, it's close enough. It's the actual binder. It's the other one. Hold on a second. I know this is, wow, interesting, folks. This is so interesting, folks. No one will be seated during the mighty comic book art pulling contest. but it is, I haven't talked to him in a while. I don't know if he's, I hope he's okay. He might be having health issues, but his name is Timothy Green, and he did artwork on, there was a backup story to, it was a book called The Annihilators, and the backup story was Groot and Rocket Raccoon. And I was lucky enough to get some original artwork from that. And if I could find it, I thought I'd grab the right binder. Apparently I didn't. let's set this here. But, oh man, hold on. It is, oh, and all right. Oof. All right. I don't know how, okay. I'll probably take a photo of this and I'll post it when I do the podcast goes up. But he did this for me. This cool. Rocket Raccoon. Now, that right there looks amazing in black and white. Doesn't need color.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of this, a lot of the artwork, to, you know, too bad it does need hell, these fucking pencils.
That's right.
These pencils right here.
Who'd have thought the comic book coloring episode would have the most swears?
Here's another Rocket Raccoon piece that he did all in pencils that I find extremely incredible. I'm lucky enough to have it. But, yeah, it's today is a lost art form, coloring as well as line work. But I guess that's a topic for another day.
yeah. The end discussion, I guess, is that not just in comic books, but there seems to be a general depreciation of coloring and its role in the narrative. I mean, I think the latest thing that's reaffirmed me of that thought tonight is the trailer for the new Star Wars animated series, Star Wars Resistance. Have you seen that, Larry?
I have not.
I only mentioned
as far as Star Wars goes.
Well, yeah. As far as Star Wars goes, I mean, you've checked out. Yeah. And the fact this has the Disney imprint on it front and center means I know for a fact you'd be rolling your eyeballs in anticipation. But I only mention it because I think one of the production crews is linked to what I thought was amazing, the Tron Uprising animated series. Did you see that?
I did not, because I was like, this is not going to last long.
It lasted a season and it died.
Because Tron Legacy, I loved it, and I was like, oh, this is not going to do so well. This is going to be like the first movie where that was, you know, a cult hit, but that cult doesn't mean financial success, which means they're not going to do another.
Tron Uprising was great. It was like flat, cel-shaded, but CG, but in Tron color palette with a kind of Aeon Flux-style elasticism and energy to the form. Yeah. This is very similar looking, however, somewhat safer, and with a rainbow of colors that have no place in my eyeballs. So it looks like a really cheap fill-in cartoon that used to come on before the good stuff started. You know, where advertisers wouldn't buy because kids were stealing it, getting out of school or something.
Say what you will about the prequel movies, but the cinematography, the color palette for the prequel movies matches the color palette for the original trilogy. And when you break out of that vibe, if you go darker, but going darker just does you no good, but you keep that kind of that grounded palette that's in that wheelhouse, you can deal with it. You can work with it. But when you start getting way too colorful, you know, it's just, no, thank you. Yeah. I don't even like the sound of it. But I think it'd be a good place to wrap up. This has been interesting, a little unexpected, but interesting nonetheless. Look,
unexpected, a little different, and I don't want anyone getting comfortable listening to the Ant King Frequency podcast. If you get, you know, used to what we're pushing out, then you know, maybe we're not doing our job right. If there is something you'd rather we talk about, if there's any opinions you'd like to share, let us know. Travis recently got back to us regarding some comments we made about the Sega Genesis. He's asking, did TurboGrafx-16 make it to Australia? That was my favourite back then, as it had the game Splatterfest, wherein you got to play as a Jason Voorhees-type character. I never actually had a Genesis. The local video rental store had one in a video game cabinet, and you could rent the use of it in-store by the half hour. That's where I played Altered Beast over and over. Trav, that sounds like a really bad deal regarding the Genesis. It's a pretty commonplace bit of kit, and that guy was clearly taking advantage of you and your friend's enthusiasm for gaming. The TurboGrafx I knew of, I don't ever remember seeing it in Australia, but one of my things I used to do in my misspent youth was go down to the library and read UK gaming magazines and periodicals. I know, it's weird. I think because I was always allowed to go to the library. I was not allowed to hang around with other kids. So as long as I was going to the library, my parents were rather happy. They didn't know I'd spend it the whole time looking up esoteric gaming. So yes, I was aware of the TurboGrafx and very envious of the artwork I was seeing in, what was it like, there was one game, Panzer Dragoon, I think, was on that. The original Art of Fighting was on that as well. Yeah, very impressive bit of kit. Larry?
I know of the TurboGrafx-16. I always saw little ads for it in comic books, but and I saw some recently for in them as What If comics I picked up. So it's I never played it. Games on a cart, you know, little card where you just slide it on in. Interesting, but I Splatterhouse. Apparently that was a really tough game, and I'm like, I'll pass on that. Tough games give me a headache and also make me angry. I don't want to destroy anything, especially renting time at a video store.
Yeah, that's bizarre.
It sounds like a prison. It's like you got your time on the phone. Here you go.
Well, just to rub it in, my local video store had a Genesis always plugged in with the latest games that you could play for free to kind of promote you to hire the games. Remember, there was always games in there. I used to still lose dollars a time playing Street Fighter EX or X-Men versus Street Fighter on the arcade cabinet that they had because that's just how I rolled. But yeah, the TurboGrafx I knew of, I was very envious of, wasn't readily available here, as was the Neo Geo, which I was a big fan of too, but never saw one, never played on one.
Apparently they're massive. Yeah. Apparently the game cartridges are size of VHS tapes. So.
Well, they were arcade quality gaming that that no one seemed to know about in the playground. So anyway, we will wrap it up there. Thanks for your feedback, Travis, as always. Anyone else want to get in touch with us, you can hit Larry up. Firstly, if you're cloud busting via the MK Ultra project, just project into his brain and you'll be fine. But if you want to get in touch with him,
it's beyond imagination.
You're going to get in touch with him with more non-Judge Anderson methods like Twitter. What would you do?
At Larry King Undead on Twitter.
And for myself, be at Antonio Sanciolo. You can hit us up on the emails, akf@whitetigergraphics.com, or what might be easier, podcast at ankingfrequency.com. There's the Facebook page. There's so many ways you can get in touch with us. Light a fire. Put a blanket over it. Throw some smoke signals up in the air. You should be fine. Message in a bottle. Kill an elder god. Yeah.
Yeah. Just not the thing sign, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it'll endure in your head. And we know all how well Sting endures. Just watch High Fidelity, and you know what I mean.
Police. What? Alfred, why must I serve the police? You must endure. The tantric sex, you must endure. And with that, we wrap it up for the week. Until next time, folks.
We'll
see you then.
The Uncanny Frequency. Copyright 2018 by White Tiger Graphics.